nothing remained because they failed. Now, at the moment, we can also remind again of the Atlantis of Bacon, namely what we have to do. He said, Bacon in the New Atlantis said that we might say the motto of the great Atlantean experiment was that man should learn to know all that is possible for man to know, and should dedicate all he knows to the unselfish good of all that lives. Now, it's a pretty big order, and we're not working that way too well at the moment, but the principles still remain true, that when the individual works for himself, his empires fall. When he works for the common good, he builds that in which is the spirit of everlastingness. Now, among the mysteries that have been involved in the Atlantean story are the pyramids. And the pyramids are very interesting things. We know that they are in Egypt. We know that they're in Central America, but a year or two ago, I saw aerial photographs of pyramids in the heart of China, which are not generally known, but they've been recognized. These pyramids, like the mounds of antiquity, seemingly have a meaning. And what that meaning is appears to be also rather uncertain. According to the conservative Egyptologists, and Mayaologists for that matter, the pyramids were simply magnificent monuments to the memories of dead pharaohs, kings, or emperors, or, if you want to be a little more idealistic, perhaps the testimonies to God and wisdom. But the pyramids are very strange things. Their distribution upon the surface of the earth is most extraordinary. Work is now being done, and I hope it will be carried on to a successful conclusion, to study and chart the locations of pyramids in relation to the magnetic fields of the planet. We know that the planet is a kind of crystal, that it has areas of fission, that it has magnetic fields, and that these magnetic fields are very important to the survival of life and to the distribution of energies. These magnetic fields may sometimes be the substitute for every method of locomotion or all forms of fuel in the world today. I went to the Pyramid of Giza, and I went through all the interior chambers of it. And there are some things about it that are very, very strange. Why should a tomb be ventilated? There are two great passageways leading from the king's chamber to the outside wall of the pyramid. They are like ventilators, not large enough for a person to go through, but large enough to permit a current of air. And then, after some time, no one knows when, the outer ends of these ventilators were blocked. But the openings to the inside are still open. The Great Pyramid's King's Chamber has in the ceiling the largest stone, I guess, in the entire structure. It weighs many, many tons. The sarcophagus, so-called, has been largely nicked away by tourists, but there is a lighter stone box, much in the shape of a casket, but too small for a human body. The way the Egyptians mummified their dead and put one mummy case and sarcophagus and over another before a final interring in the stone vault could not have been done in this case at all. It would have been utterly impossible. Yeah, also another interesting thing happened. Way back in the days of the glory of Baghdad, the great Sultan of the follower and descendant of the great Al-Rashid of the Arabian Nights, Sultan Al-Rashid bin Mamun. decided to open the Great Pyramid. He had been told that it was built by giants who were called the Shaddai, superhuman beings, and that within that pyramid and those pyramids they had stored a great treasure beyond the knowledge of man. So, taking his court with him, the Sultan went to Egypt, and he stood and looked at the Great Pyramid. And at that time, all the casing stones were in place. The four walls were perfectly smooth. There was no visible opening of any kind. And he didn't know exactly what to do. But he heard from legends where he supposed the entranceway was, and he began to dig there. And they had a very fine way of digging in those days, which I think we have improved on. They had to use cold chisels and vinegar to go through the stone. And when they got through a certain way, they did find that they had come very close to an entrance, but a great stone blocked it, and they could go no further. The Sultan or Caliph looked at the stone. He said, "Take it out." So they went to work on that stone with vinegar and very soft metal tools. And last, with a great trouble, they managed to get the stone out. And as they took it out, another stone fell in its place. And they had to go through stone after stone before they could get into the building. Now, you don't do that just to bury a fairy hole. And at last, when they got all the way in, there was nothing. The only thing they found were a series of little implements, like a little ball that could be used to make sure a surface was even. If you stood the ball on it, if it rolled off, the surface wasn't even. And two or three other little tools. And the dimensions of the building itself. Now, the Shaddai was supposed to have buried all this treasure. Did they really bury a treasure in there? Were those little instruments the treasure? And were the dimensions of the pyramid and its interior structure the priceless secret that was far more important than gold? It has been worked on. Some have decided that the Great Pyramid was a great book of prophecy. Some say that it was built by the Atlanteans. Some say that it has the most perfect mathematical form and the great most perfect measurements of anything on earth. They have measured the orientation of the pyramid, and it's oriented up to the eighth or ninth decimal point. And the little error that does exist, this little fragmentary error, is probably due to the fact that there was a minor earthquake that shook off that corner. The building was built by somebody who knew a great deal. Now, if you only want to go back as far as Cheops or Khufu, we have to admit under those conditions that the Egyptians were pretty smart people. Because if they built the pyramid, they had a knowledge not only of architecture, but a knowledge of mathematics, and a knowledge of astronomy, and a knowledge of geography that was prodigious. They knew more about all of these subjects than we knew 100 years ago. Something in this story is another evidence that somewhere in the past there was a very great amount of knowledge. And if it was true, or is true, that the pyramid was oriented to the Star Vega, then the entire history of Egyptian philosophy and mathematics is set forth in that building. The Egyptians themselves, at a very early time, said that the Great Pyramid of Giza, Pyramid Number 1, was originally the tomb of Hermes, and that in that building was the great key to the Hermetic philosophy, which was restored in Alexandria in the first century. Now, Hermes, as the Hermetic tradition tells us, was the god of wisdom, a being known to the Greeks as Hermes, known to the Romans as Mercury, known to the Egyptians as Thoth, the god of writing. And the last poem, by the way, of Longfellow was an ode to Hermes, in which he said, "Trismegistus, three times greatest, how thy name sublime has descended to this latest progeny of time." Hermes Trismegistus, the embodiment of all knowledge that is knowable of nature. Hermes was the symbol of cosmic mind, of absolute knowledge. He was described as having written all the books of the world, because every book was written by mind. He was the keeper of the great secrets of life, the guardian of the mysteries. And this work includes a discussion of the Great Pyramid. Certain Hermetic books, probably written about the first century, but credited with a greater antiquity, include a work written by Hermes, presumably, to his son Patian. And he says in this book to his son, he says, "The day shall come when Egypt shall be no more glorious, that nothing will remain of this great empire except broken columns half covered by the sand." And that was written over 2,000 years ago from existing manuscripts. So the entire problem of Egypt ties into Atlantis through the pyramids and other ancient monuments. Let's see now what we could say about this pyramid in study of man at the present stage of his evolution. For some reason we're not very sure of, the pyramid is on the reverse of the seal, the Great Seal of the United States. No one knows exactly why it was put there. No one knows who it put it there. The custodian of the Great Seal, back about the turn of the century, wrote a book on the story of the Great Seal of the United States. And he said the reverse of the seal, the front, of course, is the eagle. The reverse of the seal has never been cut, for the reason that it is nothing but the dull symbol of an esoteric society. Well, that esoteric society, of course, numbered among its followers Washington, Franklin, probably Jefferson. But in any event, the seal was not cut. Now, the soldiers of the Revolutionary War were paid their wages in what we would term feudatory notes. They were simply local printing paper with practically no value. Nearly everyone who financed the revolution went broke. But these little notes that were passed around, one of them has that pyramid on it before it was on the seal of the United States. And later, it was moved onto the states in a paper. Now, when was the Great Seal cut? It has been cut. It was cut during the presidency of Franklin D. Roosevelt and has since been found on the reverse of our dollar bill. This seal is apparently the symbol of a monument which, according to the Bible, was set up in Egypt to bear testimony. It was quite possible, and people are beginning to work more and more on it, that the study of the pyramid is very, very important to the solution of our relationship to the ancient world. We like to think in our own way that we are just here to do as we please, that we can make the mistakes we like best, that there is no definite providence to guide us, that our ancestors are all dead, and that nothing was deader than the Roman Empire. But we are not at all sure of some of these attitudes. And as our own problems increase, as they are increasing today, it becomes very obvious that we are not able to handle our own destinies at this time. We do not know where we are going. We have no idea of how we're going to get there. And about the only thing we can do at the present time is try to figure out how we can have more guns or bombs than somebody else as the basis of survival. Now, this doesn't really make very good sense. It is not the answer. There is a grand plan of life, a grand purpose. It has existed among every people, and every nation has finally turned away from it and disappeared. The ruins of the past are a constant record of the individual's inhumanity to man and his failure to keep the principles of his own survival. The science of survival, then, suggests that there must be a plan, and that that plan must be available to man if he wants it, or is he willing to do that which is necessary to have it. If he is not, he will not get it. Now, there's an interesting story we don't hear much about also. Hermes, among the books which he is attributed as having written, was one which was called the Black Book. Now, the Black Book is another legend. Very difficult to find much out about it. But one thing we know is that in England, the Order of the Garter was formed not because of an accident to a lady's garter, but because the original meaning of the word, as it appears and was gradually, colloquialized, it was the Order of the Garter, the protector. And if you have visited the Chapel of the Garter at Windsor, you will see the thrones of those who were the members of the order. And according to the ancient order, as recorded by its first great historian, Sir Elias Ashmole, back in the 17th century, the original laws and rules for the order were taken from the Black Book of Hermes on the deportment of kings. And the entire structure is so constituted and the thrones are so arranged that it represents really a heavenly temple in which all the gods of antiquity were seated. It is also a very appropriate symbol of the first great League of Nations. That it was a symbol of the union of the rulers of the world for the maintenance of peace. The Knights of the Garter were all rulers. And I remember when I looked at it, there up on the flag or banner of the chairs was the flag of the Emperor of Japan. The Order of the Garter was an international order of leadership. And the Knights of the Garter, in their ranks, drew their swords, overlapped them, and formed together a circle of blades resembling a great star. The Knights of the Garter were sworn to the protection of the weak, to the justice that is in the power of the ruler to bestow, and that all together, each in his own way and in his own faith, took his obligation to the God of his fathers to keep the peace. Then something happened. The Black Book disappeared. And the parts which had not been transcribed, which had to do with the rules of conduct down through time, have never been found. Again, something mysterious happened. But that it did exist, Ashmole assures us. The same type of thing comes with the Order of the Round Table. Another type is with the legends of Charlemagne. All of these things go way, way back. But they all lead to one concept, namely that there is an over-government of the world, that this over-government is the government of the gods from their Olympian thrones as personifications of the great forces of life by which the universe is maintained. We do not have to believe in Olympian deities, but the integrities which they stand for or symbolize are the basis of human life. And unless these integrities are maintained, nations will fall. And every nation up to the present time has passed through great vicissitudes because of its inability to keep the rules of life. In the Greek and Egyptian worlds, those who were dedicated to trying to live a better life were gradually accepted into the mysteries. And these mysteries were among the things that Solon participated in when he was initiated into the rites of the of Osiris and Isis. According to the legend, Solon was taken into the basement or cellars of the temple. He was taken way down under the earth by the side of the Nile. And in the very depths of the earth, there was a subterranean lake. And it was all black and dark. And on the shore of the lake was a little boat with a blind oarsman. And in the center of the lake was a small island. And on this small island were the two pillars of Enoch. So Solon and the priest who guided him went out to the island, and the priest showed him these strange hieroglyphic writings on these columns. And it described how various destructions had afflicted the world. And it said that the Atlantean Empire was destroyed by water. But if the solution wasn't found, if the world did not become aware from the ancient evidence and from daily living that there was no way of breaking the rules of living and surviving, then another great civilization might rise. And if this one rose, and it was necessary to punish it, it would be punished by forces moving in the air. Solon took this back. Didn't know how exactly what to do with it. But he realized that he had been in the presence of something very sacred. That the priests themselves believed this. And it was written on this column of indestructible metal that had been there before the dawn of time. Incidentally, there is a column in India that is much the same. It's in Delhi. It just looks like a pillar rising out of the ground, maybe 9 or 10 feet, maybe 8 or 9 inches in diameter, with a kind of a colophon on the top, and inscriptions in language that no one can read. No one has ever been able to read. It looks like iron. But during the Sepoy Rebellion, that column was hit by a number of solid shot cannonballs. The cannonballs were broken into fragments, and there was not even a dent on the column. It is believed that this column also goes to the story of the Orichalcum, of which the walls of Atlantis were built. Every way you trace around, you find interesting things to remind us of something. And I think what it's trying to tell us is that we are one step in a great project, a project that leads from the primitive to the ultimately enlightened. That all along the way, just as human beings are young, grow old, and pass out of embodiment, generation after generation passes, so nations after nations come and go. The great thread of life is never broken, but there can never be an enduring culture until it keeps the rules. And these are the same rules that Plato tells us about, that Solon found, namely that we are surrounded by a tremendous field of energy. We are surrounded by the potentials we have no knowledge of. Space is full of the energies and life that we are trying to now find by artificial means. The human body is an incredible instrument, and its value has been largely destroyed by the fact that the owner of the body is unwilling to treat it properly. So nation after nation rises and goes down because it does not keep the rules. And this will continue until man, in one way or another, becomes aware of these rules. Now, the speculation about the Atlantic story, to my mind, should not be where was it and what was it, primarily. But the main question is to find out what the story means and what it means to us today, to make this idea practical. We learn from this story, for instance, that a great civilization can perish. We learn that great empires can fall. But what we haven't learned really is that these disasters are caused largely by the corruptions of the human being. That man himself is his own destroyer. And that he will be his own destroyer as long as he follows the ambitions of world domination, as long as he lives to conquer peoples, as long as he lives to accumulate an unreasonable wealth, where he is willing to compromise integrity for fame, where he is willing to live only for today and let tomorrow take care of itself. He should look back and see how the tomorrow of Atlantis took care of itself. The individual himself sickens and dies from his own corruptions. Nations do the same thing. But in every nation that perishes, something survives. And one of the things that survives is a knowledge which can be reorganized, reintegrated, and reformed. We have gained from the past many skills and many wonders, but these are not enough unless we ensoul them. We can gain any skill we want, as today we are working with computers. We can have all the computers we want, but men will be born and suffer and die just the same unless we use these computers to solve the great problems of life. And having found that those answers can be discovered, live by them when they are found. All knowledge has as its final purpose that the individual shall overcome his own ignorance, and that society shall overcome its compound ignorance. And ignorance is nothing but the belief that we can break the rule and survive. So the Atlanteans left us this message, the Mayas left it to us, that the great world patterns, the great world systems with which we are concerned, have all perished from one source. We call it ignorance. And it is ignorance in a sense, because as the Chinese point out, any individual who does wrong is ignorant. No matter how learned he is, no matter how many years he spent in school, no matter how many honors have been bestowed upon him, no matter how much wealth he has accumulated, if he has not the understanding of the importance of complete integrity, he is ignorant. Ignorance is the inability to use wisely what the skills of the mind have given us. And until we realize this, we will be perishable. And just like the Atlantis of old, we shall be teetering on the edge of oblivion unless we ourselves make the necessary changes in our concepts and our conducts. Bacon pointed out that there was, in the great city of the New Atlantis, in Solomon's house, there was a tremendous collection of all of the arts and sciences that man had known. That in here, all the wisdom, all the value that humanity had accumulated was in a great museum, a wonderful place, a gallery. And also here were the busts and statues and portraits of the great illumines, those who had given man the great donations and gifts of wisdom. Here was made available to the individual the accumulated wisdom of the ages. Everything of astronomy, of medicine, of art, of literature, everything of science. So each one coming into the world comes into this gallery, and here he sees all that the world has done, all the achievements of the past, and then he is reminded of the simple fact, you have seen all these things, you know they have been accomplished, therefore your problem is to take these things and use them for the good of all that lives. Unless somebody somewhere along the line comes to this conclusion and takes this attitude towards all knowledge, the dangers of the deluge remain. The danger that we will tear down or lose a tremendous asset by abusing its use. Actually, it is the same in our personal lives. Unless we control our minds and emotions, unless we organize and rectify character and conduct, we are abusing the priceless privilege of growing, which is our birthright. And those who have abused the birthright get into trouble. So Atlantis stands for a lost cause, not lost because the gods merely wanted to destroy a people. Atlantis was destroyed because it was too dangerous to let it live. It meant that if it was not destroyed, evil would spread throughout the world, would afflict all peoples, would tyrannize and dominate and corrupt everything that exists. Before this can happen, so many laws are broken, so many energies are abused, that all these broken rules of these abused energies get together and destroy the source of the corruption. Just as evil creatures, bacillus, virus, and all these things, come and destroy bodies that have been made infirm. So in the Atlantic story, we have a moral lesson of importance, in addition to a fascinating ancient fable. Thank you very much.